All right, good afternoon. This time we'll call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. It is 2:15 on Monday, March 19th, 2012. Let the record reflect, we have the following members present: Representative Kawasaki, Representative Gardner, Representative Dick, Representative Munoz, Co-Chair Seaton, and myself, Co-Chair Feige. Purpose of today's meeting is to hear two bills: House Bill 360, Interstate Mining Compact and Commission by the State Affairs Committee, and then House Bill 365, Aquatic Invasive Species by the House Resources Committee. House Bill 360 will be presented by Representative Bob Lynn. Representative Lynn, welcome to the committee. And we've been joined by Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for hearing House Bill 360 today. For the record, I'm Representative Bob Lynn, representing District 31 in South Anchorage. And this bill is about mining and mining compact. The mining industry has historically been the cornerstone of Alaska's economy and is getting more significant every day in all areas of mining. You know, gold, silver, rare earth, and so on. Alaska currently has 7 operating mines and employs more than 200 people in good, high-paying jobs. The Interstate Mining Compact Commission, acronym IMCC, is a multi-state governmental organization representing the natural resource and environmental protection interests of its various member states. The compact's purpose are to advance the protection and restoration of land, water, and other resources affected by mining. The IMCC is the collective voice of the mining states in Washington, D.C. This bill, HB 360, authorizes Alaska to participate in IMCC as a full voting member. Currently, Alaska is only an associate member and cannot vote. Deputy Commissioner Natural Resources Ed Fogles is here to answer detailed questions. I believe Craig Conrad, Director of Interstate Mining Compact Commission, is online and answer any other questions you might have. Also have my staff, Nancy Manley, with me, with maybe answer some things. That's why I pay you the big bucks. Okay. But at the pleasure of the committee, maybe we can hear from the Deputy Commissioner.
Okay. Mr. Fogles?
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ed Fogles. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you. I'd like to just go over my thoughts on this bill and give you a little background from my perspective on the Interstate Mining Compact Commission, if I may. As you all are no doubt aware, Alaska's mining activities has been significantly increasing over the last 10 years. We now have 7 operating mines that are all significantly contributing to the economies of the state and the local areas. And they're all working well from an environmental perspective. And I think in large part that's due to what we believe is a very strong, robust state permitting and regulatory process. With that increased mining activity, we've seen a lot of increased public discussion about mining and its impacts. And there have been some that have questioned the strength and robustness of Alaska's permitting process. In response to this, we believe it's a strong process, we also believe we can improve it. So we've been doing things to try and to strengthen that. And per the governor's initiative, we've gone out there and we're trying to scrub our permitting processes from top to bottom. And I think, as we've mentioned before in various committees, but one of the key things that we're working on in trying to improve our permitting process, whether it's for mining or any other resource sector, is we're trying to improve our relationship with the federal agencies and the federal government, because with each of these resource development projects, you know, that typically the federal processes are the timeline drivers, and so they're very critical for us to understand and work with those. And that is why the Interstate Mining Compact Commission is so important to the state of Alaska. The Interstate Mining Compact Commission brings together the mining and regulatory, environmental regulatory programs from 25 member states. It's a very robust mechanism for information exchange. We get together routinely with commissioners, deputy commissioners, mining directors, and other mining, high-level mining officials from all the 25 states. We talk about our permitting processes. We find out what's working in each state. We find out what's not working. In addition, the Interstate Mining Compact Commission brings with it the full force of 25 states when it goes to talk to congressmen in Washington, D.C., in testifies in support of legislation that may be positive for the state's interests or maybe testifies against legislation that may be adverse to state's interests. It's a very powerful voice in Congress. In addition, the full weight of those 25 states is invaluable when the IMCC has discussions with federal permitting agencies back at the headquarters level in Washington, D.C. There are a lot of examples of where IMCC has really helped the state's interests, in particular Alaska's interests. I'll give you one example that I think is pretty clear and timely. Recently, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has started an initiative where they're looking at possibly taking over bonding for hard rock mining in the nation. And all the mining states are tremendously worried about this initiative because the bonding piece is the very end of a long permitting process. And if you take over that bonding piece, you threaten to take over the entire permitting process by the other states. So every state is very worried about that. The IMCC has done a spectacular job of bringing all states together to dialogue with EPA, to debate, to provide them information, to educate them on what is actually involved in developing a bond for a significant hard rock mine, and has been very effective in communicating this this information to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, so that hopefully we will be able to avoid a train wreck in this regard in the future. Currently, I'm the governor's designee to the Interstate Mining Compact Commission, and in this role, I've really seen the benefits that we have gained from this organization as an associate member, and I fully believe we're going to be very well served by becoming a full member. So I think this is a good piece of legislation, and Alaska really needs to become a full member. And so that's really all I have to say, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Vogels. Let the record reflect, we've been joined by Representative Foster and Representative Herron. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there a reason why we haven't joined it before?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, we have been an associate member for about 6 years now, and I think the reason that we haven't joined it to date is because it's not an easy process. You have to pass legislation. And we just have not got to the point where we've put together a bill to pass the legislation. Also, the dues do go up, and that's so there's a fiscal consideration to becoming a full member. I think our fiscal note is, as I understand, $60,000, and 40 of that is for the dues. It's a complicated dues formula, and it's spread out amongst all the states, and that's half of it is spread out evenly between the states, and then half of it is prorated out depending on the value of mineral production in each state. So that's a significant concern too. And then I would also say that just in recent years, our level of engagement with the federal agencies has really gone up as we try and get resource development projects permitted in the state. We're realizing that we have to work smarter with the federal agencies, and this has just elevated the importance of this organization to us.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. I had a question about what the benefits are. Currently, we're an associate member along with five other states, and what difference would that be as far as becoming a full member?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, probably the single biggest benefit would be that we'd be a voting member. Right now, associate members are not voting members, so we participate in all the meetings, and we get a tremendous value from that alone and with the information exchange. But we would not participate as a voting member sitting on some of the committees. So that's a big benefit. Plus, you know, quite frankly, I think it's important for us to pay our dues to this organization, because if the Interstate Mining Compact Commission needs more full members to be more powerful, the more full members that it has, the more powerful of a voice it will be in Washington, D.C. for us.
And just follow up.
Follow up, Representative Kazak.
Can you, I mean, maybe this is for the executive director that's on, but what kinds of things do we actually, or would a member in the Interstate Mining Compact Commission actually vote on?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, you know, that I could go into some detail on that, but that may be a really good question to deflect to the executive director, Greg Conrad. He would give you a very very good explanation of that through his eyes, if that would be all right.
Okay, I got a different question, different.
Can I follow up, Representative Kawasaki?
Yeah, on the Interstate Mining Compact. Background, it's page 104, about halfway through. It talks about by adopting the compact, states would obligate themselves to undertake and maintain certain types of programs. Can you tell me what those programs would be?
Yes, Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. Predominantly, those programs are regulatory programs for the mining industry. Mm-hmm. When the compact was first enacted back in the 60s and 70s, the state of environmental regulation for mining was nowhere near what it is today. So the original intent of the compact was to get the states together and share information to develop strong regulatory and permitting programs. So you know, at this point, Alaska has already built this program. So that, I think that part of the obligation has already been met on the part of Alaska, and that constitutes our environmental regulatory program for the mining industry.
And then a follow-up on that.
Okay, one more.
Thanks. What happens if the Compact Commission decides on more stringent regulations than we currently have in the state of Alaska? Would that obligate us to have those similar programs here in the state of Alaska?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, no, it would not. We're not obligated to that at all, and I think there's a provision specifically in the compact language that says that nothing in the compact can supersede our state laws or regulations.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned bonding in the that process. Is the compact in just commenting with the federal government, or is it in negotiations with the federal government? And if that, as a voting member, if there is a negotiation goes on, would we be in any way more bound by that agreement with the federal government than we are as a non-voting member?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, no, I do not believe we would. In the instance of the bonding initiative, the role that IMCC has played has been to bring the states together, to bring them together and call the EPA to meetings with all the states. They've brokered several of those, whether by teleconference or in person, and then they will submit comments on behalf of all the states to the federal agencies. So the negotiation that goes on is with the states and the federal agency. And again, you know, it's sort of an advisory role. I mean, nothing is binding, so that you know, the idea is to talk some sense into a federal agency that's working some initiative that may be adverse to the state's interests. And so whatever that federal agency ends up doing is going to be binding on all the states in the end anyway. So I don't know if that – did that answer your question?
Partially. I guess I'm a little concerned that the other compacts that we're involved in, whether it's fishing game, hunting licenses, those kind of things, where if we have hunting licenses here, that there's a restriction on it applies to those other states. And so I'm looking at this compact, you're telling me, then is different than those structures, and nothing would bind us more fully than are just our general agreement, or unless we pass a specific law adopting some standards. Is that correct?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, yes, that is correct. IMCC is more of a kind of an advisory facilitating lobbying body for the state's regulatory programs. It doesn't actually pass any rules or requirements beyond what's in the compact language that exists now. So as I understand it, the only real requirement now is that we have a regulatory program in place. So beyond that, it's all, you know, advisory and information sharing for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Why is it, would Alaska be the first Western state to join it?
Representative Hearn, through the chair, yes, I believe so. I should have looked. I think North Dakota or South Dakota might be a full member, but I don't know if you consider them Western states, but Mr. Conrad can clarify. But I believe we're the first true Western state to join, and the rest are associate members at this time.
Any reason why Idaho, Montana?
Utah.
I mean, Utah is an associate, but why the slow participation, I guess?
Representative Herron, through the chair. Yes, I will give you my perspective on that. And again, this would be something I think that would be real useful for Mr. Conrad to explain also. But the Interstate Mining Compact Commission originated, as I said, in the 60s and 70s. And when it started, it was primarily East Coast coal-related states. And it's had a very strong coal focus over these years. And it's just been recently that I've seen a shift to some of the non-coal issues. And I think it's been very valuable. So more of the Western states are now starting to pay attention and realize that this is going to be a valuable tool and organization for them to join in. And in fact, a number of the other Western states are now considering full membership also. And Mr. Conrad can give you the details on that, but there are at least two or three of them that are actively pursuing that at this time, although I believe we're ahead of those in our process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Vogels. I see the value in this organization. Appreciate the sponsor bringing the bill forward. I'm curious about the role of advocacy and whether or not the commission advocates on specific projects, or is it just mainly on issues, general issues of permitting and so on that might affect the states?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, it's for issues and programs. It's to advocacy is for states' regulatory programs and not for specific projects. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions for Mr. Vogels? We do have Greg Conrad online. He's the executive director for the Interstate Mining Compact Commission. Mr. Conrad?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'm on the line. Can you hear me?
Yep. Please go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. Thanks very much. I am the executive director of the Interstate Mining Compact Commission, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of HB 360 and our appreciation to Representative Lynn for his leadership in this regard. As you've heard, Alaska is an associate member at the present time, has been since 2006, and during that time, the state has had an opportunity to learn more about the benefits and services that IMCC provides to its member states, and I believe it's on the basis of that experience that the state has chosen to move forward with this legislative package to bring the state in as a full member. The specific matter that I've been asked to address with you today is why Alaska should become a full member. As with other state government organizations, is the active participation and commitment of the full member states that carries the organization forward in terms of both support and leadership. Upon becoming a full member through the enactment of the legislation before you, the state of Alaska will have a formal vote in guiding the direction of the compact. Alaska will also be in a position to chair the various standing committees of the compact and to thereby help lead the organization in directions that are favorable to both Alaska and the other member states. Alaska will continue, of course, to enjoy the many other benefits to which it has been exposed over the past 6 years, including access to all of our communications, meetings, programs, and initiatives. Alaska's participation as a full member will also be recognized and understood by those who work with the compact on a regular basis, including both the Congress and the federal agencies. And this brings a greater degree of recognition and influence regarding Alaska's participation in our work. IMCC's presence in Washington, D.C. allows us to monitor federal agency and congressional initiatives that might impact states' rights as well as development constraints on mineral issues. I believe that Alaska's participation in the organization opens avenues for the state to be heard in unique and valuable ways not otherwise available to it, and to be supported with the clout that comes from 24 states speaking together as one voice. And since we're focused solely on mining and related environmental protection issues with the federal government, we're able to delve deeper into the concerns that matter most to Alaska in this critical area of resource use and protection. And I know I speak for all of the member states of the compact in encouraging your committee to seriously consider and hopefully approve this legislation to bring Alaska in as our newest full member. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have, including some of the ones that have been posed already. I won't presume about which ones I should answer, but if any members of the committee would like to bring those up again, I'd be happy to provide some additional input. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Conrad. Representative Kawasaki?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Conrad, for being online. The question I had earlier dealt with the terms on the compact background. It says by adopting the compact, states would obligate themselves to undertake and maintain certain types of programs. Have you reviewed Alaska's laws to see that we have those programs currently in place?
Yes, I believe that you do. I think that the key aspect of this is that we are not a regulatory body, so we do not as a matter of course or as part of our purposes or objectives require regulation by the states. We advocate and encourage states to develop programs, regulatory or otherwise, in the area of mineral resource development and protection that would demonstrate leadership by the states in these areas, thereby encouraging the state to lead. But my understanding of Alaska's laws and regulations is that you are in a very good stead.
Follow up, Representative Kawasaki.
A separate question. It was brought up earlier. Of the 19 current member states and 5 associate members, there's 3 of the big top 10 mining states that are missing. They're all western states: Arizona, California, and Montana. As well, Colorado and New Mexico are only associate members. If you've been around since 1970, why haven't other states joined on?
Deputy Commissioner Vogels answered a bit of that when he said that when we began, we were primarily focused on coal-related issues back in the 60s and 70s. There was a major piece of national legislation called the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act that was very critical for the states because it had a state lead concept being developed as part of that. And the compact was developed in the midst of that active environmental and resource federal legislative effort during the late 60s and early 70s. And as a result, they were primarily focused on coal-related issues. So the coal states were the initial states that joined, formed the compact, and advocated for many of the key legislative proposals in Washington. As time has gone on, we've expanded our scope and our focus beyond coal issues. In fact, in the current environment we have in Washington, I believe that there is much focus on non-coal and hard rock issues as there are on coal issues. And as a result, I believe that the Western states have seen over the course of the last 10 to 15 years the value of being part of an organization like IMCC that is focused solely on mining issues for the states. And with that, we have seen more Western states becoming involved in IMCC, beginning with New Mexico and expanding to the most recent associate member was Colorado. I have been in negotiations and discussions with the other states you've mentioned, Arizona, Colorado, Montana. I met with Nevada's Mineral Resources Committee just 2 weeks ago, and Nevada is seriously considering coming in as a member state. So it's a process. I think over time, folks have to understand a little bit about you, the organization, how you work, what your interrelationship is with the folks they deal with in Washington as they see the value in that. They become more and more interested and become a part of our work, which is exactly what's happened. And that would also explain, by the way, the process of these newer associate member states understanding the work of the compact and now moving toward full membership. And we're working on development of legislation in both New Mexico, Colorado, and Utah, where draft bills have been developed, and we're just looking for the appropriate opportunity for those legislatures to see these bills introduced and acted upon.
Any other questions from the committee for Mr. Conrad? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question would be, has there been, since the original group joined because of the coal issues, have there been any more that have joined lately, or is this just starting to kind of start out and you're just starting to get new members?
Well, the newest members who are joining have been almost all Western members with a hard rock influence. And I think that has been the impetus for their interest. So the newest member states that we're looking at are the ones that are similarly situated to Alaska with regard to both issued concerns and their regulatory focus. Does that help?
Well, what I was meaning is, are there any new states that have already entered IMCC, or are they just starting to?
I'm still a little confused about.
Okay, I have a list here, and it says member states, and it's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. Okay, so we have 19 of them. Are they all the original coal, the states that had coal issues? And now because you've expanded, some of the associate members are thinking about joining. Has there been any of those states that have joined already, or are we all kind of at the same time this year? Everybody's going to try to join.
Oh no, it's been a process by which folks have been have come to know and been exposed to and been involved with IMCC. The first state to join was Kentucky back in 1966. It required four states for the compact to be in place and effective by the originating legislation. So we started with Kentucky, then Pennsylvania. North Carolina is a member state, but North Carolina does not have any coal development. So way back in 1967 when they joined for purposes other than coal because they don't have coal development, followed then by Oklahoma, West Virginia, and then South Carolina, which is also does not have coal development. So we've seen a number of states involved that don't have coal. Most recently, the states that have been involved, that kind of new impetus and effort for newer states began in 2000 with New Mexico, followed all the way through 2007 with Colorado. And now the newest states we're looking at are Nevada and Montana.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm trying to understand the coalitions based on the people, or not the people, but the states that are our entrants and those that are not. Now, you know, in our state here, we're just considering, you know, several different coal deposits for strip mining, which is Wishbone Hill, Chewitna River, and actually about four others of those. And then when you say hard rock, you know, we're considering open pit mining of several different prospects here in the state, you know, large scale, and as well as their underground hard rock mining. So when you say hard rock, are you talking about underground mines, or are you talking about open pit mines? Just wanting to find out what group of states we're going to be in a voting membership with, and whether, you know, how that vote compares with the other 19 states, and whether our interests align.
Thanks for the question. I do believe that they align. I think we have a very broad range of interest from the states in all types of mining. So when I say hard rock, non-coal, maybe even more embracing, and as well as the different methods of mining, underground, surface, open pit, the work of the compact is generally driven as much by the kind of national issues that are in front of us in the federal agencies or in the Congress. So Ed mentioned the financial assurance or bonding requirements, which really pervade all types of mining, not just one type of mining or one type of mineral. Another area that we've been working on is like mine safety and health legislation, which embraces both coal and non-coal and different types of mines and mining. We've been involved with the issue of coal waste and coal combustion waste and other kinds of mine waste, which again don't necessarily respect just one type of mining or one kind of mine. So depending upon where the issue is being driven from, I believe it covers a plethora of different types of mining, and as a result, we have interests from all of the various member states in the development of these particular issues, be they on Capitol Hill or in these agencies, and the states find themselves generally very well aligned when it comes to developing our positions on any particular legislative or regulatory issue. We operate generally by consensus and often find that member states have a fairly wide and embracing interest in the issues before the compact.
Representative, you can follow.
Thank you. I'm still trying to get a handle on some of those issues. So let's take, for instance, Montana. I think they've if they are considering this, they've enacted a prohibition on the use of cyanide. I don't know which other states are there. Has that been an issue that's come up, and how has that been handled or not handled or at the compact level?
Okay, thanks. That's a good example. There has been concern about the use of cyanide at mining operations over the years and in the recent past. And generally what will happen in the context of the compact is a state will bring that issue to the table in terms of how it's impacting their particular state, generally from a regulatory perspective, and will share that information with the other states in the compact in terms of from either an informational perspective, or if there is a particular rule of a national scope, it will give all the states an opportunity to weigh in on that. States are usually not positioning themselves with respect to what's happening in the respective states other than being aware of that and offering, you know, their kind of advice and counsel as a particular state may be dealing with a particular challenge associated with that issue. But unless it raises to a national level in terms of a federal rulemaking, the compact would generally not be taking a position on what's going on in a particular state. We would leave that to the states themselves, but would obviously benefit from hearing from one another about how we're dealing with those issues, and there's a lot of value that comes from that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, Representative Herron, then Nunes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then one, at the appropriate time, one question for Mr. Fogles. Mr. Conrad, I appreciate your being here with us. Article 8 of the compact, entry into force and withdrawal, has there ever been a state that has had the need to withdraw?
The only state that withdrew was New Mexico in 1983. And then they rejoined the compact in 2000.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm thinking of a mine here in the Juneau area that had difficulty with the Corps 404 permit, and for many years and lots of delays that the permitting was very difficult. And I'm wondering how the commission would help in the absence of advocacy on a particular project, how would the commission help to communicate to the federal agencies that there could be problems with the permitting in a particular situation?
Thanks. A couple ways. With regard to core requirements for 404 permits, what we have done recently is that issue has been brought in front of the commission by several states, including Alaska, who are struggling with this, and there's been the benefit for them to share, again, the type of challenges they're facing so that they can benefit from the advice and counsel of the other states about how they've been dealing with the core. And to the extent that the core, for instance, recently has moved forward with a rulemaking on nationwide permits for coal mines, we would then be able to develop a position on that rulemaking and communicate that through formal written comments, through testimony at public hearings, and potentially raising it as part of oversight hearings on Capitol Hill to the extent that those hearings were initiated and they were looking for a perspective from the states about what the impact this is having on our ability to regulate in these areas. And the impact on our respective mining industries in the states. So those are the various opportunities that states would have to pursue an issue like nationwide permits under 404.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from the committee for Mr. Conrad? Thank you, Mr. Conrad. Appreciate your testimony. And
do you need me to remain on the line here with you? I'm happy to do so.
If you would, just in case any other questions come up, we'd appreciate that.
Certainly. Will do. Thank you again.
And before I open public testimony on House Bill 360, Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sometimes the administration supports legislation and sometimes they do not. What is the position of the administration on this bill?
Representative Herron, through the chair, we support this legislation.
Thank you.
Okay, at this time, we'll go ahead and open up public testimony. In the room, we have, Mike Satre from the Council of Producers. Council of Alaska Producers.
Thank you, Chair Feige and the rest of the committee. My name is Mike Satre. I live here in Juneau, Alaska. I'm the Executive Director of the Council of Alaska Producers, which is a nonprofit trade association representing the major metal mines and developmental projects here in the state of Alaska. The Council supports this legislation, and we support the state of Alaska joining in as a full member of the Interstate Mining Compact Commission. You might wonder why, since we don't seem to get any direct benefit from it, but you know, we believe that Council of Alaska Producers, Alaska has one of the most rigorous permitting processes in the world for mining. We think that because it's rigorous, it's science-based, it's transparent and predictable. But what is rigorous one day might not be the next. And the only way that you can continue to stay at the top of your game is by finding ways to continuously improve. And one of the ways you do that is by sharing information with your peers. So in this case, the other mining producing states. By joining the Mining Compact Commission as a full member, we'll be able to exchange information and best practice, best regulatory practice and reclamation practice with states that have been mining coal for many, many years and have lots of experience with that. And that's going to be incredibly important for us as we look to develop new coal deposits in Chewitna, in Wishbone, up on the North Slope, and in other places. In terms of metal mining, this is a chance for Alaska to take the lead amongst Western states in terms of showing the West how we do it responsibly in Alaska, how everybody in the West should be doing it, and really laying the foundation for a properly regulated mining economy throughout the West. In fact, you should be asking yourselves not why aren't the other states part of this, but how can Alaska take a leadership role in this? You know, Alaska sometimes is the voice in the wilderness. You look at our attempts to take the lead in Arctic policy, for example, and in this case, we can join in with other mining states and become a policy leader by being a full member of the committee. One of the main reasons that the council supports this is actually echoed on the IMCC's website. And I want to paraphrase briefly from this, if I could. On their website, they say the IMCC was founded on the premise that the mining industry is one of the most basic and important to the nation. At the same time, it is essential that an appropriate balance be struck between the need for minerals and the protection of the environment. But we recognize, or the IMCC recognizes, that individual states have the power to establish and maintain programs of land and other resource development, restoration, regulation appropriate to cope with the effects of mining. The IMCC would not shift the responsibility of these programs. On the other hand, the member states believe a united position in dealing with the federal government affords us a decided advantage. The Commission feels strongly that the collective voice of many is important in our efforts to preserve and advocate states' rights. So if the state of Alaska is going to continue to seek primacy on permitting and regulatory issues, this is the most appropriate forum to do it from the mining industry standpoint. With that, I appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill and look forward to any questions you might have.
Questions from the committee from Mr. Satre. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike, you know, obviously in your business, you're well aware of comments made by people that are opposed to mining. For me personally, as a legislator, I'm going to support this legislation. But have you heard of anybody opposing Alaska joining this commission?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, not personally. No, I have not.
Any other questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Mr. Sager, appreciate your testimony. This time, is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 360? Nobody online? Okay. I'll go ahead and close public testimony on House Bill 360. Discussion amongst the committee. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think in this first hearing I'm favorably disposed. Mm-hmm. However, I haven't had a chance to hear from either the mining industry or others in my district, so I am reticent to ask to move the bill out at this point in time. I'm not wanting to hold the bill up, but I would prefer to have, you know, till the next meeting so that we can contact the people in our district. I mean, we haven't heard from, I appreciate Mr. Satre was here, but, you know, there's individual mine operations and all in many members' districts, including mine, and I would like to talk to them about this. It is this unique situation where we would be joined with mainly eastern states instead of the western states, and hopefully there'll be other western states come on, but I would like to find out that information from my constituents.
Those eastern states aren't all bad. Of course, New York's not in here. So. Okay. Anything else from committee folks? All right. We will set.
Actually, they are.
What's that?
New York.
Are they? Imagine that.
It's a suspect now.
Salt miners now. Okay. I'll take that under advisement, and we'll set aside House Bill 360 for the time being, and plan to move it on Wednesday, move it out of committee on Wednesday. So if anybody comes up with anything between now and then, please bring it to my attention.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. At this time, we'll go ahead and start up on House Bill 365. It's currently 3 o'clock. The next committee isn't due in here until 3:45. He extended the time for Labor and Commerce. So we'll plan on running until about 3:30. And if any members need to leave to be elsewhere. So, Representative Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a House Resources bill, and so the impetus for this was the hearing that we had earlier this year in House Resources on DVEX, which was, I think probably everybody remembers that graphic hearing where we had slides of Whiting Harbor in Sitka. And the thing that came to most of our attention was that we had pictures of the summer of 2010, and then we were still seeing pictures of that facility that had all that common name sea vomit growing from it, pretty much deteriorating in September 2011. So well over a year in which this invasive species was in the area. The purpose of this bill is to look at where we have an invasive species in a limited geographic area and to give Fish and Game, DNR, DEC the tools to do rapid response on an emergency basis instead of waiting 1 or 2 years and letting that invasive species potentially spread throughout the area. So this is not a case where we're looking at a infestation that is in general or has spread along coastline, but looking at if we get an invasive species in one limited geographic locality that we can rapidly respond to that instead of taking a long time to study it while it may then transmit itself along the coast and then really not be a solvable position. The bill as it reads is aquatic invasive species, and we have had comments on that because aquatic, although what we were doing when we constructed the bill was thinking of marine aquatic, it doesn't say marine aquatic, and therefore it's all inland waterways as well. And there is a question as to whether that is the same situation and whether we want to provide those same kind of emergency powers in those kind of situations. You know, one of the things that has been brought up is pike. Pike are endemic and spreading in some areas, and the idea is not for something that has become endemic or that has spread to then treat a massive amount of the environment, but if we have a situation where we have an aquatic species come in to a limited area, if we can treat that and nip it in the bud, that is the objective. You have on your table the it's actually got a cover letter from Linda, but it's the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the Invasive Species Overview. And in 2002, the department did a management plan to address the threat of invasive species. And this is simply the executive summary. The actual plan is 100 pages long. However, if you look beyond that, you look into the plan, you find that it really is talking about, although one of the first things was to develop on page V, 5, but labeled as a V, develop an inter-division Alaska invasive species prevention and response program within ADF and G. However, as you go through the plan, you find that it is really talking about listing and educating people ahead of time and looking at those kinds of things instead of an emergency response capability. And so what we're trying to do, and if you look on page 6, which would be VI, you can just go right down all those bullet points and you'll see that none of them are dealing with rapid response to quickly identify and respond. Representative Gardner had a question, I guess.
Representative Gardner, go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, that actually caught my eye, Representative Seaton. On page V, Roman numeral 5, about halfway down the list of following actions is prevent the spread of invasive species already introduced through the identification and closing of transport pathways. Develop protocols for early detection, rapid response to control and management of new invasive species. And I guess I did kind of interrupt you a little bit, but I'm wondering if you have asked if these things have been implemented, because it seems to me that if they were implemented and the other actions, we wouldn't be here.
And, Mr. Chairman, that's correct, and our understanding is this is on the shelf. And has not been implemented, but we will hopefully we'll have testimony from them on that. And, you know, our problem is that most of the time we are faced with the situation of department coming back and saying, well, we weren't able to do that because we don't have legislative authority for an emergency response. We have to follow the regulations and do the studies and all those kind of things. So what this bill attempts to say is that if we have a limited infestation, if we call it that, geographically insulated, we can come to the point where they don't have to consider, let's take DVECs in Whiting Harbor. So that you wouldn't have to say, well, there might be sea urchins in there, and we do have sea urchin fisheries that occur sometimes, so we have to study the quantity of sea urchins and go through a long process of this balancing regulatory things. This would, for that limited geographic area, put a priority on the stopping of the infestation. And so that's the tool that we're trying to provide with these, you know, emergency procedures to get around on a limited geographic basis our normal procedures of taking, of doing scientific work to study something for a long time, because if you're studying for a long time, the threat of something migrating out and becoming endemic along the coastline with huge implications, not only ecological but also economic, are huge. I mean, if we had DVECs that would transform along the coast and become endemic where we have mariculture in southeastern could become basically defunct. If we looked at the Sitka Sound herring fishery and we had DVECs spread among the various bays, I don't think fish and game could ever have an opening in those areas, because you have nets in the way the fishery takes place. You have fishermen with seine nets. They bundle up the fish, and then you have tenders come along. We pump right out of the nets, and anything that's there, including DVECs and all, would come into there. Then those tenders might go to Petersburg or Ketchikan in the offloading that's pumped out, and that discharge water goes in, and we would be spreading that all over the state. Even nets that were used in that area would then come up to Homer, because we have a number of fishermen, and even transferring those nets off, they are transferred off by using, you know, hand pulled up over the side with hydraulic blocks. But seaweed and everything could fall off into the harbor, and then we could establish that as far as way as Homer. So the whole idea is to make sure that we get to the point where we know if we have an isolated area and we can respond, and we give ADF&G and DNR the tools to respond on an emergency basis. We're not trying to declare in here the emergency. We're just providing the tools. I would hate to have something happen like the spread of DVEX along the coast and then us have a problem and be told, well, yeah, but the legislature didn't provide us a mechanism for emergency response. So that's the whole purpose of this bill, and whether it's perfect or not, in fact, I think that, you know, we've got a couple of amendments to look at to make it better, and that's the purpose of this initial hearing, is to find out from testimony from DNR and ADF&G, as well as others, where we need to tighten up or loosen up this bill so that they have authority to do what we need to do in an invasive outbreak.
Thank you. Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, I guess it's a pretty pretty short bill, page and a half. Again, the big thing is talking about rapid response and allowing the necessity for response in a limited geographic area, basically a bay, to be able to focus on that as being the activity in that bay that needs to be done. There's been some concern that the way the bill is written, it says ADF&G has to drop everything in that whole management area and concentrate all their people on that. That's not what was intended, and so we'll clarify that with potential amendments when we get to that point, to say, you know, we're talking about the management of that limited area, so you wouldn't have to say, well, there might be some sea cucumbers in that area, and we have to identify the number of those or sea urchins and that kind of thing. So that's the intent of the bill and the way it's structured. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the five fiscal notes for this, and just between the sports fisheries and the agriculture from natural resources and sports fisheries from fish and game, it's almost it added up to $938,000 just from those two alone. And if we did narrow it down to marine aquatic invasive species, I think that would help us be able to get this through, because of those two fiscal notes alone is going to put a barrier into even be able to get something done. And I think that we know how important it is to get a quick response, because we don't know how far the invasive species in the Sitka area in Whiting Harbor, how far that has traveled now, because the response wasn't quick. So I think it's very important that we do something, but we need to make sure that we can do something that's possible.
Thank you, and Mr. Chairman and Representative Wilson, that is one of the two amendments that we have coming. The other one just clarifies that the management is talking about the management in that particular geographic area, not that they have to put that as priority over all their management of all the fisheries in the management region. So there was most of the fiscal note does come, and most of the problems come from, you know, the freshwater aquatic, addressing both freshwater and marine at the same time, and that idea that, oh, they have to drop everything and only prioritize that for their whole management area. That was not intended.
Okay, any other questions? We've got questions? Representative Munoz.
So as the plan is being developed, then how do you deal with ongoing emergencies like the Sitka situation?
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Got to start someplace. I guess that's where I'm looking at is that I don't think that the Sitka problem was responded to in the timely fashion that should have been. I think that there are things that we're probably going to have DNR request that they write into leases for mariculture, so that if a mariculture site is contaminated, the farm lease has already agreed that if there's an invasive species identified in their particular area, that they agree that they're probably not going to be compensated for the destruction that's going to have to occur to sterilize that that mariculture area. But when you get into these things, if you have this dual contest between economics of, let's say, a mariculture farm, or let's say there's a fishery that wants to go in and harvest sea urchins, and that can become a huge struggle within within Fish and Game, because we haven't given them the statutory obligation to prioritize the killing of the invasive species over in that local area, if it's a localized infestation, over other concerns. And so to get around those kind of conflicts, which simply just stretch out and delay the response, that's what we're trying to provide here. But we can't back up in time and do anything for it, I'm afraid.
Any other questions? This time we'll go ahead and open up public testimony. Got two folks online as well as one in the room here. Online for questions, we have folks from Department of Health and Social Services, Department of Environmental Conservation, Fish and Game, and the University of Alaska Southeast out of Sitka. So first, Mark Finzel. He's the executive director from the United Fishermen of Alaska. if you would, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hello, Chairman. My name is Mark Vinsel. I'm executive director for United Fishermen of Alaska, statewide trade association representing 37 member groups from fisheries throughout the state and our offshore waters. United Fishermen of Alaska supports this bill in concept. We are very aware of the tremendous threat of invasive species, marine aquatic species, as well as some that can happen inland, and the potential devastating effects they can have on their fisheries. It's pretty clear. I don't think any state has as much to lose as Alaska does on this. We're pretty fortunate to be in the situation we are, with the geographic distance and a lot of factors that have some of these things either slower growing or just less problematic than they are in many states. But it's most important to have rapid response capabilities in advance before something like this happens. And that's the basis for our support for the bill. We've supported previous bills that would have set up an invasive species council, but we do recognize the very difficult it's difficult to predict who's the most important agency. In some cases it would be DNR, in some cases it would be Fish and Game. But this bill's focus on aquatic and marine species really puts it strongly in Fish and Game. So we'd be very interested in the advice from Fish and Game as to how best to make this work in their organizational structure. With that, I'll thank the committee for introducing this and convey our general support for the concept of the bill and answer any questions if you have any.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pinsel. Any questions from committee? Thanks, sir. Appreciate it. Online from the Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District, Darcy Echeverry.
Hello, this is Darcy Echeverry. I live in Fairbanks, and I am here representing the Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District. Over the past year and a half, I've been working with the district to coordinate management of Allodia in the Fairbanks area. And as you know, Allodia is an aquatic invasive plant that has the potential to impact Alaska's freshwater resources and fish habitat. This plant, when introduced into freshwater systems, has the capability to restrict flow, increased sedimentation, and even damaged fish habitat. The current known distribution of Elodea in Alaska is limited to a handful of lakes and sloughs in Anchorage, the Cordova area, and in Fairbanks. The time to act is now, and we need a coordinated effort from all state, federal, and private agencies. Up until this point, the response effort has been led by nonprofit and federal agencies, but we need support from state agencies who are the managers of these state waters to lead this response effort. The Department of Fish and Game has a management plan, which you've already discussed, that was created in 2002. It outlines how to accomplish effective management. And according to this plan, Fish and Game adopted a policy that utilizes the following action strategies. Development of an interdivision Alaska invasive species prevention program. Provide leadership and coordination between state, federal, and international agencies and tribes and NGOs. And develop protocols for early detection and rapid response to control and manage new invasive species. I think that this plan is an excellent framework to coordinate aquatic nuisance species management in Alaska, but it appears that few of these tasks have been accomplished to date. If the plan and the adopted fish and game policies are not sufficient to facilitate early detection and rapid response, then I am in favor of House Bill 365 and having aquatic invasive species rapid response entered into Alaska's administrative code. I urge the committee to also consider the cost of implementing any invasive species response plan and to please provide the agencies with needed resources and personnel. I discourage the committee from eliminating freshwater habitats from the bill, as these freshwater invasive species can be detrimental to fisheries and economies as well. So I thank you all for your time and attention to aquatic invasive species management.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Echeverry. Questions from the committee? Oh, very good. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up, from the U.S. Forest Service, Trish Schwartz.
Hi, my name is Trish Schwartz. I'm actually testifying as a private citizen. I'm a member of the Fairbanks Cooperative Weed Management Area. As Representative Seaton described, in October 2002, ADF&G issued its Aquatic Nuisance Species Management Plan. This plan is chock full of excellent descriptions about what the department planned to do to prevent the introduction of invasive species and, I quote, to eradicate them as quickly as possible. I'm sorry to have to report that very little of what was described in the plan has actually been undertaken. My particular concern is the invasive aquatic plant Elodea that was discovered growing in Chena Slough near Fairbanks in 2010. I'd like to illustrate the seriousness of this discovery by telling you what other states have gone through or are going through with invasive aquatic plants. A close relative of Elodea, called Hydrilla, was introduced to Florida in the 1960s. In 20 years' time, Hydrilla spread throughout the state of Florida. In the worst infested lakes, you cannot boat, you cannot swim, you can't fish because you can't draw a line through the water, and fish can't survive because Hydrilla fills the lake from top to bottom. The state of Florida now spends $20 million per year solely to trying to control Hydrilla. Learning from Florida's failure to respond quickly, the state of Minnesota did act quickly when Elodea was found growing in a single lake near Minneapolis in the fall of 2007. Minnesota DNR mapped and treated the infestation with aquatic herbicides within 2 months of its discovery. In Idaho, an infestation of Hydrilla was found in the Brunel River in December 2007. In 3 months, the Idaho Department of Agriculture had treated the infestation with aquatic herbicides and mechanical pulling, and they have successfully killed it off. In upstate New York, an infestation of Hydrilla was found in one of the Finger Lakes in August of 2011. By October 2011, a coalition of groups had worked together to treat the infestation with aquatic herbicides, and they had petitioned the state legislature of New York for $1 million to kill it off completely. These states seem to understand what the term rapid response means. In contrast, since August 2010, when the Elodea infestation was found in the Fairbanks area, all Alaska Department of Fish and Game has done is grudgingly and I mean grudgingly, attended a few meetings. We need the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to get to work. We need them to demonstrate real leadership and true rapid response in defense of Alaska's freshwater resources. So please don't give up the freshwater component of this bill. I strongly support the section of the Bill 365 that says rapid response shall be given priority over other activities of the department. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Wirtz. Any questions from the committee? All right, thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 365? You want to introduce your amendment?
Sure.
Okay. At this time, we'll take. I guess we've got two amendments to take a look at.
Before he introduces amendments, can I mention something first?
While everybody's looking over the amendment, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another thing, and I don't know if there's anything that we can do about this, but in the incident in Whiting Harbor, what happened was that the owner of the aquatic farm said, well, I can take care of this and do it, and I think it was like for $30,000 something could have been done. And but he was told by, I don't know whether it was the feds or our State Department, I don't know, because there were several different, you know, the feds were involved, the state was involved, so I don't know which group told him, but they told him that he couldn't even go into the area himself to do any of that. And because of that, he lost the whole farm. He lost that totally, and if he would have been able to be in there to do something, it could have been saved, or at least some more, a lot more could have been done at the time. And is there any way that we can do something immediately, and maybe that would have to be under the regulations, but so that the person themselves that might be involved, if it's an aquatic farm or something like that, that they could be involved enough that they aren't told that they can't go in at all, so that they can salvage what they can. Or I'm just thinking that that's something to think about, because this poor guy, you know, lost everything.
I think she's asking you.
Okay. Representative Wilson, the rapid response is not dictated here, but it dictates that any of those methods, chemical, biological, mechanical, or physical methods, singly or in combination, to control the occurrence or eradicate the aquatic invasion in that limited or isolated geographic area. So there would be nothing in this that would say that the department couldn't allow him to put, you know, put plastic around there and use chlorine. I mean, it's one of those easy things. There's powdered chlorine in every fishery processing place around the state. There's liquid chlorine. There's things that can be used that, when it becomes dilute, is naturally occurring anyway. I mean, you know, we got sodium chloride and we got chlorine, and I mean, as that would become dilute afterwards, there wouldn't be an effect, but that would probably have done exactly what you're talking about. So our hope is that the plan that Fish and Game develops will be inclusive enough to allow, if they spot something, you know, to allow the most rapid response there can be. But I also, and hopefully we'll have DNR as well, because DNR does issue the permits for mariculture sites. If there is something there, we need to have in the leases a recognition that this isn't going to be a long court battle, that if we've got a marine invasive, that is it limited to that site? That's got to be taken care of right away. And if there's damage or something else, that's just going their understanding that part of their lease is that somehow we've got to incorporate those things so that we get over those hurdles of saying, oh, well, this is going to be this long fight between the owner and Fish and Game. It has to be that there's an emergency rapid response capability.
Representative Gardner, did you have a simple question along those lines?
Yeah, and because I think whatever we do, we have to find a way to also make sure that people aren't so afraid of it being discovered that they don't go underground and try to hide it, that people are willing to quickly come forward and say what they have seen, where they have an interest in it, know about it. Because the fellow that Peggy talked about, if it happened to him again, you can bet he's not going to tell anybody. If he doesn't have to. Yeah.
Why don't you go ahead and move amendment?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move amendment number one, which is 27LS1439/A.1.
And I'll object for discussion.
And, Mr. Chairman, for the listening audience, that's to page 2, line 11, and that the leading activities of the department and activities regulated by the department, and inserting activities regulated by the department in that limited or isolated geographic area.
Any questions for Representative Seaton? Representative Gardner?
Well, what if something is discovered that's not an isolated area?
Mr. Chairman, If we have something that's endemic or that's spread into many areas along the coast, it's not going to be an emergency response that can take care of it. Then we are going to be in a full-blown position. Hopefully they'll be able to use some of those same techniques and all, but that that the difference between, like Whiting Harbor, you can cordon off and you can chlorinate, you can do many things, but the idea of this is to say there was misinterpretation that the activities of the department and activities regulated by the department meant within the whole management area. In other words, they'd have to drop everything and just concentrate on that. And what the intent of the language was, it was not clear, I agree, was that if you identify something in a bay, then the other activities in that bay will become secondary, and we can have emergency response based on making sure the invasive doesn't spread. So that's what this amendment is attempting to accomplish.
Any other questions for the committee? At this point, I'll remove my objection to amendment number one. And hearing no further objection, amendment number one is adopted. Amendment number two, if I could move that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would move conceptual amendment number two. It's being passed out, but basically it adds marine before aquatic invasive species throughout the bill. And I'd like to also comment that on line 19 on page 11, where it says or freshwater, would also fall into that same category of removing or freshwater.
I'll object for discussion. Representative Munoz?
Oh, I just note in the fiscal analysis of the bill that I think one of the species, at least one of the species, is a freshwater plant. And would the removal of the insertion of marine change that focus, or would you still be intending to go after freshwater plants?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This would remove that freshwater plant. It would also remove pike and other freshwater species. This is kind of, where would we want to be, or the art of the possible? At this point in time, we have marine invasive species that, have quite different modes of transport, and we have mariculture in ocean water. We have, you know, commercial fisheries that are taking place, which are somewhat different than the situations in freshwater habitat. And so, although I agree with the people that testified that, you know, some of the invasive plants, Elodea and others, would be very necessary to address, I'm not sure that at this time putting all of those issues in the bill is so much weight that the bill won't be able to move through and get through in a rapid time. It also is, that's where most of the fiscal note comes from, because you're trying to look at all of the freshwater ways in Alaska instead of, you know, the coastal habitat, which has a lot more similarities than the freshwater habitats throughout the state. So reluctantly, I would have to answer that this would remove the freshwater habitat and the freshwater fishes from the bill, but it's for practical reasons.
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, are you saying that the odds of passing will decrease if we don't do this? And because earlier you mentioned you get started somewhere and you start going for it. And we would say that for the freshwater also. But if that means we do nothing, this is the sausage making. I'd like to oppose this amendment for the very reason that you mentioned earlier.
And Mr. Chairman, I would like to not propose the amendment for the same reason. However, I think that the weight of trying to deal with the diversity of emergency regulations applying throughout all the freshwaters of the state and what that planning would do for the bill and the fiscal notes and the diversity of issues that it has to go through complicate the bill so much that I think we would do nothing. And I really hope that we won't be in the position of saying we have an invasive species and it was the legislature's fault for not having something in place that could have rapidly done with green crabs coming in, and they're found in one place in southeastern, and we don't do anything with it because we're going to study it for 2 years, and then we get consensus, you know, wide spreading. So it's reluctantly that I offer the amendment, but I think the amendment's necessary if we really want the bill to move.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I can, I guess I can agree with that, but, you know, this is the House Resources Committee, and as far as House resource policy goes, I think to distinguish between marine environments and not talk about inland aquatic environments, I think it sort of misses a big part of the discussion. I think that if the Finance Committee, the next committee referral, decides to make some changes to the fiscal note or somehow pare it down, I think that's fine. But to not give the Department of Fish and Game this rapid response for all aquatic invasive species, I think it's a bad state policy. I'll vote against the amendment. Against the amendment.
Representative Herron.
Mr. Chairman, given that we'd like to see this rapidly go through the system, we probably should tie a day POC.
Perhaps that could be amendment number three. Representative Wilson, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with the other two legislators that it's really sad that we can't do this whole thing, but the amount of money was for seven more positions. Most of it was going to the seven more positions that it would had to take to zero in on each one of those individually, and we all want that. It's a shame that we have to look at it in such a way, but because of that, I will vote for the amendment, just because I think we need to.
Representative Munoz.
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the argument of the sponsor in this regard, but I agree that with some of the previous speakers that we really need to stay focused on the immediate threats, and the aquatic, the inland aquatic threats are very serious. Just recently, last summer, I attended a conference, national conference of state legislators, and this was one of the key issues that some of our western neighbors are talking about. The state of Montana has established a $10 million fund to respond to emergencies in their state. So I really think that we need to move forward with all of the identified species, and I will not vote for the amendment. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? At this point, I'll remove my objection.
Okay.
Okay, we have an objection.
Mr. Chair, before we go,
Representative Gardner.
I'm going to support the amendment, but I would just like to say why, and I'd like to consider the other part of the bill to be a template to get started on the issue and the lessons learned in efficiency and how best to respond and things like that. I would hope we will apply or expand to inland waters as well.
Okay, Representative Kawasaki, maintain your objection.
Okay.
If you would call the roll, please. Question is, shall we pass conceptual amendment number 2?
Okay. Representative Herron?
Yes.
Representative Munoz?
No.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Dick is absent. Representative Gardner?
Yes.
Representative Kawasaki?
No.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Co-Chair Feige?
Yes.
Co-Chair Seaton?
Yes.
6 yay, 2 nay.
By a vote of 6 yays, 2 nays, conceptual amendment number 2 has passed. We are currently at this point out of time. I will not close public testimony. I would.
We could move the bill and keep it moving.
What's that?
We could move the bill and, you know, keep it moving through the process.
I was just going to hold it to the next meeting because I would like to get an answer from the Department of Fish and Game. One of the things that testimony has brought out here, you've got the Aquatic Nuisance Species Management Program going back to 2002, and I'd like to hear from the department on where are we at with this thing. I mean, if it's on the shelf, it's just a piece of paper taking up room. If there's something else that the department needs or perhaps needs to be reprioritized, I'd like to hear from the department along those lines. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd also like to ask DNR to come back with to us on the marine permits that they give for mariculture and whether new permits or a modification of existing permits somehow to identify and what they think would be the way to enfold emergency response to invasives in localized areas there.
Okay.
Can I have one more point?
Representative Munoz,
one
then Kawasaki.
Request for the Department of Fish and Game, I believe it is, to give us an update on the Whiting Harbor situation.
Okay. Representative Kawasaki.
And one more for Fish and Game. In reading the fiscal note, I know this isn't necessarily the group to discuss the fiscal note, but I think that there's probably ways to save money before it goes on to finance so that we can address the all marine or all aquatic invasive species. So we'll try and work with you on that.
Okay, fair enough. My intent is to hold over both 365 and 360 until Wednesday. And so if anybody comes up with anything, get it to me before then. We'll deal with those bills on Wednesday. We will also hear from the Department of Revenue on your favorite friend, oil and gas taxes and credits, where we are today. With that, the House Resources Committee at 3:43 is gaveled out.